The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
And now back to Lifeline with Craig Roberts.
San Francisco, as we know, is one of the most expensive places in the entire country to reside. So the notion of helping people try to make ends meet is probably an altruistic one, if not a wholly unrealistic one. Add to that the perhaps misplaced notion that the uptick in crime that we've seen, largely post-COVID, largely since 2020, is directly attributable to economic times. Now, what kind of falls apart with that observation is that when you start to look at the kind of crimes taking place, often it's not people who are going to the grocery store and stealing bread and bologna because their kids are hungry. It's people that are stealing because they know they can sell the goods for higher prices so they can go out and buy some toy, or people that are trying to feed a drug habit. So there may be some serious thought that we need to give to the notion of creating some sense of economic structure. We've often heard it tied into basic income or universal basic income. You've heard perhaps those phrases utilized, the notion that, for example, in San Francisco, every single San Francisco resident would receive a minimum amount of money. If you have a job, probably doesn't apply to you, but everybody would get a minimum amount of money, and the thinking goes that with that, it will alleviate San Francisco's crime problem. Really? Well, let's get some insights from Dr. Robert Wright, Senior Research Fellow at the American Institute for Economic Research. And Dr. Wright, we appreciate you taking some time out of your schedule to be with us. First, take us back a little bit of perhaps perspective here. In terms of the notion of so-called universal basic income, where does that find its roots, its genesis?
Well, thanks for having me on. You know, Thomas Paine is often attributed with the first universal basic income scheme. He came up with the idea about 15 or so years after writing that famous pamphlet, Common Sense, that launched the American Revolution. And he had been influenced by what he saw during the French Revolution, and you know, but it wasn't seriously taken up. It's a very difficult policy to implement in some ways, and you know, some people are behind it because you know, supposedly it's easier than unconditional, or excuse me, than conditional. You know, traditional welfare payments, because you don't have to verify anything. You just send checks out to everyone, sort of like the stimulus payments that the federal government's been making periodically over the last 20 or so years. But of course, the money's got to come from someplace, and that is that's the rub. That's the that's the tough nut to solve.
Yeah, and you know, we kind of going through much of the stimulus payments that we saw during COVID, you know, and I've often laughed. People have talked about the notion that, well, one of the reasons why it's so difficult to get people to come back to work now is because they're enjoying all of this free money, as if a stipend of $400 or $1,200 is suddenly going to be a life changer. That said, I guess there is a bit of which that unproven notion of give them a little bit of money and it will solve all their problems ties right into this. Now, I understand that one of the proposals here are at least under consideration in San Francisco, is a universal basic income of $15,000 per year. Anybody that lives in the city of San Francisco will immediately tell you if it was $15,000 a month, you might struggle to make ends meet. Where do they come up with these numbers? And just as important, Dr. Wright, where are they going to come up with all this money?
I don't know, and I don't know. What I do know is that I have 99 problems, and every single one of them I can trace to the government. We used to, in this country, have a large number of charities, some religious, some secular. They were paid for by donations. And it was said, and I think, with a good deal of truth, that both parties gain from the transaction, both the giver and the recipient, because the giver was giving, some of his or her income voluntarily to a specific person or group of people who they felt as though they wanted to aid in some way, right? So they can legitimately feel good about themselves. They are in many cases legitimately fulfilling religious obligations. It gave people reasons to go to church other than purely spiritual ones, and it truly created community. Real communities, not the way that the word is thrown around, today, to mean any group of people who are all trying to get the same thing from the government. But with these various UBI programs and the gift, the guaranteed income for transgender people, and the abundant birth project, and all of that. Basically, what the government is doing is taking money from people who have some and giving it to groups that the government thinks needs it. And a lot of times it looks arbitrary. It looks like it's virtue signaling. And the amounts, as you noted earlier, seem arbitrary or capricious. Like they're just coming up with figures. And, sometimes those figures are just because that's what they happen to get from a foundation, which is the way it's been working. These pilot projects have been working in most states. But California's flipped the script, as it often does. And in California, it's the government that is funding many of these, some directly, and sometimes, like in South San Francisco, via the YMCA. So they say, oh, no, it's a private entity that's doing it. It's the YMCA. But the YMCA got the funding from the government. And, of course, that means ultimately from taxpayers.
Wow. And I'm curious in terms of the kind of research that's gone into this. I mean, they come up with these numbers. They come up with these ideas. Has there ever been in the background work and investigation that you've done been a case of an example, either here in the United States or overseas? I know sometimes these sorts of, very social feeling programs are popular in places like the Netherlands and Finland and so forth. They tend to be a little bit more experimenting when it comes to social ideas. Is there any example of where this has been applied that has shown an appreciable change in quality of life and an appreciable decrease in the crime rate? I mean, if the argument is we need to do this because the reason why we have high crime is because people are not making enough money, then that would suggest to me that just the opposite ought to be true, that once these sort of money giveaways are applied, that we should see an instant change in the crime rate.
Yeah, I wrote a book about UBI with Alexandra Przygalinska of the Kaminsky School of Management in Warsaw, and we looked at UBI experiments and pilots and whatnot throughout history and throughout the world, and there really hasn't been yet a true experiment you know, with the control group and all of that. But what we have noticed is there's this tendency where the proponents of UBI say, "Oh, look, well, the people who got the money report that they're better off." you know, like we needed, that information, right? They also tend to, you know, do all sorts of things, and it's, you know, it's hard to tell if they're just inept as social scientists. Or that they're very clever and they know exactly what they're doing, but there's also a tendency to forget about the fact that cash is fungible. So they'll say all sorts of things like, "Oh, well, the money was spent on Bibles and medicine," without looking at how the increased income affected the entire range of purchases from the household, right? As if there were discrete dollars or other currencies coming into these people, and then they were, you know, saving those in a jar and then just buying the Bibles and the medicine with the money. So it's really kind of a mess, and so that's why, you know, as a researcher at the American Institute for Economic Research, where we put a very high premium on science. What I have to say is that I can't reject the hypothesis that UBI doesn't do anything on net helpful for society. You know, we just don't know, in other words, is the layman's way of putting it, because there have been no true attempts to, you know, to try this out society-wide. They always fail on at least one of the three main categories that the Basic Income Earth Network puts out as, you know, the definition of UBI. They're either not universal, where, you know, certainly money that just goes to trans people or to artists is not universal. They're not basic, meaning that they are either too little money, like in Alaska, or they're sometimes too much money, and they're never really an income in the sense of a lifelong stream of money. They are always, you know, they run for a year or two or three at most, and it's not clear that that's long enough to affect people's behavior on important things like criminality or educational attainment. All of these things run in at least two directions, right? So UBI proponents say, "Hey, you know, well, people will now have time to get an education," which is true, but also means that education will be less valuable to them because of this stream of money that's coming to them for nothing.
Well, you know, I'm certainly no scientist by a long shot, but I have to suppose that there's something that seems to be terribly elementary or fundamental or basic in the conclusion that, you know, if the survey is, if everybody got free $15,000, would that help out? Would make life better? I don't know anybody that would say no to that, including even a few people that make over $500,000 a year would say, "Yeah, an extra 15 grand, you know, we're going to get you an airplane and go fly to New York for the weekend and go see a show and have dinner and come back." You know, life changing? Maybe not. Would it improve your station in life? I think anybody would argue that. Whether or not, though, it's the kind of sustained improvement that is suggested is necessary for people that are living at the lowest income rungs within society, well, that's probably an entirely different story, particularly if that money is being metered out over a projected amount of time. You know, as I suggested in my opening remarks, it seems to me that, you know, $15,000 will be life-changing, maybe if you got it every month. Over the year, here in a city like San Francisco, not so convinced. If you've just tuned in, Dr. Robert Wright is with us today, Senior Research Fellow with the American Institute for Economic Research. We often couch this discussion in terms of how it benefits the least of these. Now, when we come back, I want to talk about the opposite side, and that is the economic consequences. For example, what San Francisco is presuming, if you use a baseline of about 815,000 residents, could cost the city upwards of $12, $13 billion a year. That's only almost twice its existing budget. So what about the sustainability of any of these ideas? We'll talk about that next as Lifeline continues.
And now back to Lifeline with Craig Roberts.
So normally in a healthy economy, there is an exchange of labor for wages, and that goes to produce products that then get sold, and then the income comes in, and the process, the cycle sort of repeats itself in the simplest, very simplest of terms. How do you go about just giving money away, and where does it come from? And if it's coming from taxpayers, where are they getting it from? That maybe is the big part of this equation, that, you know, at a level to say every individual ought to have at least a minimum ability to have enough money to be able to survive. I don't know if 15 grand in San Francisco is surviving, but nevertheless, it's the where does it come from part of the equation that seems to be also pretty murky. Dr. Robert Wright with us today, senior research fellow with the American Institute for Economic Research. By the way, he has either authored or co-authored or edited over two dozen major books, book series, and collections, including The Best of Thomas Paine, published in 2021, and Financial Exclusion, published in 2019. So, Dr. Wright, what of that big question? I mentioned San Francisco. We're looking at essentially doubling the budget. So where does all that extra money come from?
Well, the $12 to $13 billion that you noted would be the gross amount. But one of the dirty secrets about UBI is that, of course, your taxes would go up. So the net would only be, you know, kind of spitballing $2 to $3 billion per year. Because, you know, you're going to get that $15,000, but they're going to tax you $20,000 or $25,000, right, in order to be able to make the payments to the people with no or very low incomes who won't be paying any taxes and will get the full $15,000. So my question in that op-ed in the OC Register was, what else could we do or could San Francisco do with that $2 to $3 billion, especially if it, you know, wants to focus on crime? And I think Mary Thoreau at the Independent Institute in Oakland, right across the bay from San Francisco, had an interesting idea, which was to remind San Francisco and other policymakers in California that the European drug model is not to have open air, free drugs and free needles and people living in tents and so on and so forth. The European model is rehabilitation. So they take people off the street and they get them drug treatment in order to get them to stop using drugs. Right, so that $2 to $3 billion could be used for a program like that, where it's actually, you know, would be illegal again to camp in Tenderloin and to defecate, you know, in the Presidio and all of that. But the notion is you get people, you know, the treatment so they get off the drugs and maybe could start to pay taxes. That reminds me of an op-ed I wrote several years ago. It didn't get much traction, unfortunately, which I called California's Green Minimum Wage, where I suggested that it should be legal for people to be able to work on organic farms in California for room and board, like in the old days, right? So that organic farmers could get the labor they need, and people who don't want to live on the street could get some job experience and and make some organic food for everyone else.
Well, and at least if there's a component where there's as I suggested earlier, normally it's, you know, cash in exchange for labor. There's give and take here as opposed to just a free giveaway, which, as we've suggested, is wrought with all kinds of potential problems, not least of which is where's the money coming from? And, you know, it's easy to say we're going to raise the taxes. At what point do citizens say, you know what, this just isn't worth it, and finally say, I'm done. So the notion of at least saying, look, there's all kinds of jobs that need to be done, street cleaning and sweeping and you know, I mean, we could come up with lists that would be days long, that at least there could be some modicum of dignity attached to an effort to try and provide this sort of minimum living wage, although, again, arguably, it's neither a wage nor is it minimally sufficient in a city like San Francisco. Dr. Wright, we're out of time. Boy, there's so much more to peel back on this onion. I'd love to get you back on the program to discuss further. Just absolutely phenomenal content and so much that we need to be made aware of and understanding that there are more and more cities that are talking about things like this. And, you know, San Francisco had a history of being the city that knew how. I'm not so sure if maybe that does need a little bit of fine-tuning these days, but let's see where it all takes us. Dr. Robert Wright, Senior Research Fellow with the American Institute for Economic Research, we appreciate your time and your insights.
And now back to Lifeline with Craig Roberts.
An honor to introduce to you a relatively new member of the KFAX programming family, and we certainly want to invite you to tune in weekday afternoons at 2:30 p.m. here on KFAX for, albeit a new radio program, though he's been on television for many, many years, the broadcast Discovering the Jewish Jesus. And joining us now is its host and speaker, Messianic Rabbi Kurt Schneider. Rabbi Schneider, thank you so much for taking some time to be with us today.
God bless you, my friend. Thank you for having me on, Craig. I really appreciate it.
You have got a fascinating background, and by way of introduction for many of our listeners that are new to your program, and we certainly want to encourage them to discover more about your radio and television ministry, but let's start with a quick little primer on some of your background. Understand that you're originally from Cleveland, Ohio. You took your bar mitzvah in a conservative temple, and then spent, I guess, a good portion of your high school and collegiate days in wrestling.
That is true. That was my identity. I had a one-track mind, completely focused on it. And my goal from seventh grade up through the time that I graduated high school, Craig, was to be state champ in Ohio at the weight class that I wrestled in, which at my senior year was 119. I used to listen to my Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young album before going to sleep at night, laying in my bed, envisioning with my hand raised in St. John's Arena at Ohio State University as state champ, and chills would go through my body. And I got to a place where I felt there wasn't anybody that I couldn't beat. And as long as I stayed in that world, I felt great. But when I walked off the wrestling mat after wrestling my last match in high school, recognizing I was going into a world that was much bigger than 119 pounders, it was like the world was pulled out from underneath my feet. And everything just came collapsing down. I didn't know who I was anymore, didn't have direction anymore, went from feeling like I was in control to feeling completely not in control, vulnerable and afraid. And I struggled like that for 2 years. But in 1978, at the age of 20 years old, having no understanding, I never even thought about Jesus. He was as far away to me as the man on the moon. But in 1978, I went to sleep on a hot August night. Again, never had read the New Testament. No one had ever witnessed to me. And in the middle of the night, Craig, I was awoke from my sleep into a conscious state of awareness. I was suddenly aware that I wasn't sleeping, a very high sense of something happening. And then Jesus appeared to me in a vision of the night. It was in color. He was on the cross. There were some people in the distance looking at him as he was being crucified. And then a ray of red light from straight through the sky, from straight even above the blue, came down on his head. And when I saw, Craig, the ray of red light come through the sky onto Jesus' head, I knew the light was coming from God. I understood the symbolism of it. And he was telling me that Jesus was the way to him. I knew as an American that the person on the cross was Jesus. That's all I knew. But that was the beginning of my faith journey over 40 years ago.
So as a young man, I'm curious, Rabbi, had you at all been actively involved in your Jewish faith? Was that something more obligatory from the standpoint of, well, this is what we do, this is what mom and dad want, so you're going to go through kind of the routine, so to speak. But I'm curious, had that been a day-to-day component in your life at all prior to that supernatural encounter in 1978?
Well, my family was very much culturally Jewish. But in terms of viewing their Jewishness as a sense of being connected to God as the chosen people, that wasn't there, which was the case of, you know, all the people that I knew. Most Jewish people, you probably know, are very secular. There's an Orthodox community and so on, but the vast majority of Jews, even in Israel, are secular. So we were very, very culturally Jewish, and I always had a very strong belief in God, but I didn't relate to God through some type of rabbinic system. I was bar mitzvahed, and I went through all the training for that, but in terms of relating to God through the rabbinic Judaism, that was not part of my universe.
Now, I understand you had a little bit of a brush, at least we'll call it, with supernatural. There was a time following your tenure at the University of Tampa that kind of looking to find where your next niche was going to be. You became an encyclopedia salesman, which I guess today is a bit of an endangered species with the internet. But you had gone to a motivation sales meeting, and I understand at that meeting met another salesperson who had been engaged to some degree with Eastern mysticism, and in particular, if I recall correctly, had introduced you to a yogi that claimed to have supernatural powers. And it is not long after that that God, in fact, revealed himself to you in a very supernatural way. Fascinating.
Well, yeah, you've done your homework, my friend. Did you read my book, Call to Breakthrough?
You know, I haven't yet, but that's going to be on my agenda for sure, because I find your story so captivating. You know, that notion, it's kind of a Romans 1 thing, that notion that God will reveal himself to each and every one of us. And in even the notion of unreached people groups, you know, the Lord cares about us so much that God is going to find a way to be able to communicate with us. And if he has to do it supernaturally and directly, he will do it. And that certainly is what happened in your case.
Very, very true. And Jesus has a chosen people. You know, he said he would build his church and the gates of hell would not prevail against it. And so when we preach the gospel, this is just taking a side step here for a moment, but when we preach the gospel, we don't have the notion that everybody that we preach to will come to faith in Yeshua. But what we have faith in is that God will reveal himself to his elect. Even Jesus, in John 17, he prayed, Father, I pray not for the world, but for those whom thou hast given me. And so he revealed himself to me, Craig, in a way that he didn't reveal himself to any of the other Jewish guys that I grew up with. And I think, you know, I was chosen before the foundation of the world, as the book of Ephesians says, that all of his children were chosen in him before the foundation of the world. That's one of my favorite portions in the Word of God, that we were blessed with every spiritual blessing in the heavenly places, just as we were chosen in him before the foundation of the world and predestined to adoption in his love. So I believe that you know, God, you know, has had a special plan for my life and a special call, and that's why he revealed himself to me so powerfully.
Yeshua, certainly during his end of time of ministry here on earth, had warned us that we would be persecuted for his name's sake. And that certainly has been a big part of your own personal testimony. I understand that your parents' reaction was startling, to say the least. I mean, after all, here's this nice Jewish boy walking about town telling all the neighbors about Jesus. Their reaction, though, to your discovery of Messiah was pretty profound, pretty forceful. Tell us about that.
Well, it absolutely was. I think there were, first of all, two ingredients that caused them to react so forcefully. Number one, when wrestling ended, I was going through an identity crisis, and they knew that I was struggling. So they didn't know what was going on. That would be the first point that I would make on their behalf. But secondly, I think they were very, very ashamed. I mean, for a Jew to be walking around their Jewish neighborhood, my parents totally felt the shame of that. I mean, the one thing that you cannot do as a Jewish person is believe in Jesus. If you're an atheist, you'll still be accepted by the Jewish community. If you practice Buddhism, you'll still be accepted by the Jewish community. But as soon as a Jew names Jesus as their Messiah, bam, you're out. So my parents took decisive action. They hired the most famous deprogrammer at the time. Many of your people probably know what a deprogrammer is, but some may not. But particularly in the 70s, there was a lot of Jewish people that were getting involved in cults, as well as Gentile people, too. It was the age of, time of Eastern religion. And so this guy, Ted Patrick, had a son that he was able to rescue out of a cult. So he ended up going into business as a deprogrammer, and parents would hire this guy. Basically, I was abducted by him and his bodyguards. They flew him in from California to Cleveland, where we were living. My dad told me we were going to go talk to somebody about buying a restaurant. And when we went to the hotel where we were supposedly going to be conducting a business meeting, I was abducted by Ted Patrick and his bodyguards. They then took me to California, where they took me to the beach in the day, the bars at night, took away my wallet, took away my car keys, had nothing. And they thought that if they could get me away from whoever they thought was programming me, that I'd come back to my senses. But obviously, I was marked by the Lord. So that didn't happen. And then when that didn't work, my parents, even took further action. So, yeah, I think it was, my parents were very ashamed and, tried to do whatever they could to stop me from following Messiah Yeshua.
I'm curious in that moment, and I find it completely fascinating, that shows a bit of the short-sightedness understanding of these deprogrammers. Certainly, if you had been engaged in a quote-unquote cult, separating you from the cult leader that could no longer influence you, well, that might make sense. But in this case, a little bit difficult to be separated from the Spirit of God, because he's always abiding with us. But I'm curious in terms of what was going on in your own heart at that time. You have had this supernatural experience. You have begun to study the claims of Messiah. You've, in fact, fully embraced him as now a Messianic Jew, a completed Jew. And your folks are not taking very well to this. And, I've got to believe, with the best of intentions, it created this scenario hoping to draw you out of this cult called Messiah. And yet, I'm wondering, in the middle of all of that, what was your sense in terms of where the Lord was? Were there moments that you were questioning yourself and saying, God, why are you allowing me to experience all of this?
No, not during that first action that they took. In fact, when I was abducted in the hotel room, basically what happened was we walked into the room, the door closed behind me. Ted Patrick said, I was sat on the bed. I knew I was in the room. He said to me, Kurt, we're going to talk about cults. I said, I'm not in a cult. I said, I just believe that Jesus is the Messiah. He said, well, you've got nothing to worry about then. So I stood up and I said, well, can I leave? And one of the big bodyguards said, sit down. So I knew I wasn't going anywhere.
Wow.
So I said, well, can I go to the restroom? And that was part of the hotel room. They said, yeah, you can go to the bathroom. So I got on my knees in the bathroom, Craig, and I said, Lord, I don't know where this is going, but I just pray that you'll keep me. But I had no questioning of my faith at all. But it did get difficult in the second action that they took. So that was a more difficult episode.
But clearly, through all of that, the Lord was strengthening you, and that relationship was deepening. And it's an absolute fascinating story of conversion, and shows that, when we see the depiction of Christ leaving the rest of the flock to go find the one sheep that has been, kind of headed off from the rest of the group, that God is serious about that in terms of drawing each and every one of us to the foot of the cross. We're visiting today with Rabbi Kurt Schneider. His broadcast, Discovering the Jewish Jesus, maybe you're familiar with the television program, now on radio, weekday afternoons at 2:30 p.m. right here on KFAX. More information available on the web at discoveringthejewishjesus.com. That's discoveringthejewishjesus.com. We'll take a brief time out, come back to more of our conversation as Rabbi Kurt Schneider joins us on this edition of Lifeline.
And now back to Lifeline with Craig Roberts.
On this segment of the program, unpacking the amazing story of my special guest in this segment, Rabbi Kurt Schneider, host of Discovering the Jewish Jesus. The broadcast, by the way, comes your way each Monday through Friday at 2:30 p.m. right here on KFAX. So we invite you to tune in and check it out. You can also get more information on the web at discoveringthejewishjesus.com. That's discoveringthejewishjesus.com. Rabbi Schneider, I want to kind of move the story along because there's another topic I want to get to before our time runs out. But it sounds like then, following that experience, obviously the Holy Spirit had a strong hold of your heart. You eventually went into Bible college. You studied for the ministry. You went into full-time ministry in a mainline Protestant denomination. And then, after a while, decided to take a sabbatical and went into working as a motivational speaker. But it was during that period of time that the Lord not only called you back to ministry, but eventually called you to the ministry that you're engaged with today that's had a very strong focus on outreach to Jewish people around the globe. Tell us a bit about that.
Well, people oftentimes think that my ministry is focused only on Jewish people. Really, my heart, Craig, is just to preach God's word. Really, discovering the Jewish Jesus helps God's people understand, whether you're a Jew or a Gentile, understand how the Old and New Testaments fit together like a hand in a glove. You know, the first verse in the New Testament, Matthew 1:1, says, "This is the genealogy of Jesus Christ, the son of David, the son of Abraham." So the very first verse of the New Testament connects Jesus to the Hebrew Bible, the Old Testament. So we need that foundation under our faith, under our feet, to fully appreciate who Jesus is and how he fulfills everything that's written in the Word of God from the book of Genesis onward. So my mission is to preach the whole gospel to the whole world. And my goal is, I know that it sounds preposterous, but my goal is I want every man, woman, and child on the earth to have enough information about Jesus through my ministry that they can either accept him or reject him. So I'm a preacher of the Word of God. I'm an evangelist. And I think I have a gift in making things simple so that people can understand. But getting to your point, my friend, we have just recently launched in early March an international movement called TakingTheRainbowBack.com. And what a great day, Craig, to be interviewed by you. And by the way, you're a very fluid interviewer, and I really appreciate it. You're really easy to flow with. But what a day to be interviewed by you when it's the first day of Gay Pride Month in San Francisco, no less.
Yes, this is I guess that's true. This is now June 1st. Yeah, absolutely. Tell us a bit about this initiative, and you know, we understand certainly the rich symbolism from God's promise, you know, following the great flood, and of course the beautiful reminder every time we have a rainstorm and the sun begins to come out, how many of us have just been in absolute awe and wonder seeing the arc of the rainbow, and even sometimes a complete point to point arc in its totality of the rainbow, and reminded of that promise of God. That's been co-opted, though, hasn't it?
Well, it has, and it's been so hijacked that Christians are even afraid to associate with the rainbow. But the reality is, Revelation 4:3, John on the island of Patmos sees God on the throne. And John said in Revelation 4:3, there was a rainbow around the throne. And Ezekiel 1:28, he saw the Son of God glorified. He was in the form of a man, Ezekiel said. He had fire inside him that went upward and downward. And all around him, the prophet said, was the radiance like a rainbow. So the rainbow is a manifestation of God's beauty and glory. And I've had personal experiences and encounters with the Lord where he manifested himself to me in rainbow light. So I've been very connected to the rainbow going back now 40 years. I didn't even associate the rainbow in all those years, you know, until, you know, obviously the last 5 years particularly. I didn't even really associate the rainbow with the LGBTQ movement. But this movement, this ideology, this same-sex blessing that the culture has now, and the gender dysphoria and transgendering, all this is, as you know, this just thing just erupted suddenly. It was in the water for quite a while. It was in the Kool-Aid, so to speak, but it erupted just in the past several years. And something rose up in me, Craig. And I mean, I believe it was the fire of the Holy Spirit that rose up in me. I want you to stand up and I want you to speak out against this thing. My mission is to empower God's people to come together in unity, to lift our voices and to take a stand for righteousness. We need to speak up. We need to speak out. We need to drive the forces of darkness away. Not that we can change America, but we can certainly influence the sphere where we're living, whether it's our family or our workplace or wherever that is. We can have an impact. I want to encourage everybody that's listening right now to go to my website, Taking the Rainbow Back. The last word is back. TakingTheRainbowBack.com and join the movement. We've got thousands and thousands of people all over the world that are getting involved in this. It's so important. This is a battleground that the church needs to stand on and fight.
Boy, so much to unpack, and we certainly appreciate your time today, Pastor Schneider, Rabbi Schneider, and would love to get you back on to go a little bit deeper into this subject matter. Visiting today with Rabbi Kurt Schneider again. He is the host of Discovering the Jewish Jesus, the broadcast weekday afternoons at 2:30 p.m. here on KFAX. More information available again on the web at discoveringthejewishjesus.com. That's discoveringthejewishjesus.com. And our thanks to Rabbi Kurt Schneider for being with us. Well, that's going to do it for this edition of Lifeline. Thanks so much for being with us. And if there was anything you heard on today's show that you'd like to hear again or share with a friend, grab a copy of the Lifeline podcast. Simply log on to KFAX.com. That's KFAX.com for the Lifeline podcast. Our producer is Wanda Sanchez. I'm Craig Roberts. Till next time round, remember, just don't keep the faith. Get out there and share it and make it a great evening. So long.
Opinions expressed in the preceding program do not necessarily represent the views of the ownership, staff, or management of KFAX. Copyright Salem Communications, all rights reserved.
Three-star General Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never-before-seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.